no helicopters have been procured for me to go to golf course. Thank you.
I've never said he wasn't a great politician. I'm just saying he's a cop.
He's listening to you.
How'd you play out there today?
Well, I found the conditions challenging, mostly because there's no grass on the golf course, but there never has been.
I'm thinking about the swag bag, and I have high hopes for the swag bag.
When you got three crevices on the green, your course is trash.
What is happening, folks? Welcome back to the Beltway Golfer Podcast. I'm your host, Alex Dixon. This is episode 96. It's been a minute since we taped a podcast. There's a lot going on, especially as it pertains to the DC golf course saga. The latest being, of course, that Trump and Doug Burgum, the Secretary of the Interior, as well as Tom Fazio, golf course architect, and his son, went out to East Potomac. They had plans that looked more expansive than the ones that were released about a month and a half ago. And then immediately after their visit, Trump announced that renovations would start September 1st at East Potomac. The court case, which I'm involved in, being one of the three plaintiffs in the suit against the Department of the Interior related to East Potomac, is still going on. And there was a hearing after that visit by the President Burgum and Fazio, in which the DOI's lawyer stated that nothing has been decided and they haven't even chosen an architect and the final plans are not set yet. So who knows really what to believe, and we'll see what happens on September 1st. But that court case continues. And in the meantime, I wanted to bring on a gentleman who has covered what's going on quite a bit in his own newsletter called The Quadrilateral. He is a prominent voice, not just in golf, but in golf course architecture. He has gotten his own hands dirty on a couple projects. Mr. Jeff Shackelford. He's been a golf writer for many, many years. I certainly encourage anyone to go subscribe to his newsletter, The Quadrilateral, where he covers golf's majors. So he also has some opinions on whether or not East Potomac could, in fact, host a major like the administration hopes that it could. Before we get to that conversation, though, other stuff going on since our last podcast. We published a magazine, issue one of the Beltway Golfer magazine. Is out. It went to press. It's been published. Subscribers should by now have it in hand. We've gotten tons of awesome feedback. The response has been incredible. And we're off to work on issue two. If you're just hearing about it or you're not familiar, go to beltwaygolfer.com. You can subscribe there. It's going to come out twice a year, a spring summer issue as well as a fall winter issue. If you just want to test it out, you can just purchase the first issue and check it out. It's a heavy weighted stock paper, something that you're going to want to put on your coffee table, not just throw in the recycling bin. And it's just interesting stories about golf in our region, whether it's golf courses or people or history or stories. It's anything that we find really interesting. And we've got 9 great articles in the first issue that if you're a golfer in this region, I'm sure you'll find interesting. It took a little longer to get the first issue out, but it is here, and we've been dropping off promotional copies around the area to different clubs and golf courses and retail shops. And so keep your eye out or head to beltwaygolfer.com to get a copy of the inaugural issue of Beltway Golfer Magazine. Super pumped about that. And again, we are off and started working on issue two. So if you have any pitch ideas for the magazine, if you want to get involved, if you want to advertise, shoot an email to innerloop@beltwaygolfer.com or shoot us a message on Instagram is generally the place that we're on the most. You can find us there and we'd love to hear from you. 2 sponsors to talk about before we get to the episode. 1, The Golf Yards is opening up right now. Your new 24-hour-a-day spot to work on your game. They've got 8 TrackMan hitting bays, state-of-the-art gym, multiple short game areas, including an indoor bunker with real sand that you can chip onto an artificial green. It's got 2 other well-putt putting areas and 24 hours a day right in the heart of Arlington, overlooking I-66 in Ballston. They've been doing open houses for the last few weeks or so. Head to thegolfyards.com. You can get all the information. They're currently waiving initiation fees. Follow them on socials at the golf yards. But pumped to be a partner with them as the place looks fantastic. Also, Golfdom, your golf kind of retail superstore that's been in Tyson's Corner at their flagship location forever. They also have locations in Annapolis and Rockville. They've got everything you could possibly need as it pertains to golf. We've been shopping there for forever, it seems. But they've got all your latest and greatest drivers, irons, putters, and apparel from brands that you're not going to find at your local pro shop. You're not going to find them at some of the other big box golf retail stores. And they've got all the accessories you possibly want. And they've got a great used selection of pre-owned clubs in their back nine section, at least at the Tyson's location. You can go find them online at worldwidegolfshops.com/golfdom. But a great store, and thank you for being a partner. That's it. Let's get to the conversation with Mr. Jeff Shackelford. Again, go check out any number of his golf books, but his newsletter is called The Quadrilateral, where he primarily writes about the majors across golf. But great conversation with him. So here it is, episode 96 of the Beltway Golfer Podcast. Enjoy. All right, Mr. Jeff Shackelford, welcome to the Beltway Golfer Podcast. How are you, sir?
I'm doing great, Alex. How are you?
I'm fantastic. I really appreciate you taking some time to come on and chat with me and talk a little bit about DC golf with us. We're just meeting for the first time, and we've exchanged a couple messages on social media, but pleasure to meet you. I reached out to you to be on the podcast in part because you have written a couple pieces, one larger piece in your very popular newsletter, the Quadrilateral. I always struggle with that pronunciation.
Everybody does. It's okay. That's why we go with the quad.
With the quad, about the situation that has is continually unfolding here in the D.C. area about our three municipal golf courses in Washington, D.C., East Potomac, Langston, and Rock Creek. For those that don't know, you've kind of got a wide resume in golf, everything from you've written 12, how many golf books have you written?
10 golf books.
10 golf books. Are there other books than they're non-golf books?
Well, one book about a racehorse named Zenyatta. Yeah, it's more of a photo book, but there's some writing in that.
All right, 10 golf books, but you're involved, but also you're a golf course historian, golf course architecture historian. You've been involved in the restoration at LACC and the design over at Rustic Canyon. So you understand golf course architecture very well. I was looking behind, right before we started recording, I was kind of examining my mess of books behind me, and I was wondering if there are any of your books up here, and sure enough, there's the Masters of the Lynx is up there. Most recently, I think I read, this was a little while ago, but your Golf Architecture for Normal People, which I enjoyed very much. I recommend that. All of which to say is you kind of got a wide swath of knowledge and influence within the golf world. But when this news broke about the administration terminating the lease of National Links Trust of the three golf courses, the rumor started, I think, in late November. The timeline is even getting fuzzy for me now. But you wrote a piece in the quad before the lease was even canceled in December. So my first question would be kind of what were your initial thoughts when you kind of heard the administration was getting involved?
Well, I was horrified, and I do try to keep a very somewhat narrow lane with my newsletter because it was a choice I made a few years ago to really focus on the majors and the cup events that matter. The reason I decided to write about this, I think what's so exciting about what the National Links Trust has been trying to do is to help these public golf courses with great bones get back to the way they once were without having to host a major tournament. And that's not a knock on Bethpage or Torrey Pines. In fact, those are inspirational in a way because these were places that were in kind of sorry shape. And the justification of having a tournament was fantastic in terms of bringing, I don't want to say restore, but rejuvenating those places. And that has been maintained. And they're amazing success stories for the most part in terms of where they were and where they are now. But it did require the things that come with a major tournament, either a tour event or a major championship. And that's fine. But we know that tends to lead to money being spent or design choices being made for 1 week in a 15, 20 year period or something like that. Bethpage has more frequent events. And so what's so incredible about what Will and Mike and the National Links Trusts are doing is that we don't need a tournament. This is really about the people who about making these places that function on a daily basis function better and getting the most out of what they can be, and showing another audience what that architecture does matter. You know, some people just sure. think, well, you could just should just get the course in better shape and that's all you need. But we know, especially with Washington, D.C. and its heritage with architecture and design and the vision for the city, that it's practically criminal that a place that, and frankly, I didn't know about it when I did my Golden Age book many years ago, has this design that was such a forward-thinking, just incredible piece of history that deserves, I'm talking about East Potomac, deserves to be brought back. And
yeah.
So, and then the last component is this is something that probably the USGA, and we can explore this more, but should have been doing after Bethpage more of. And so, again, my admiration for what they're doing at the National Links Trust, I just can't even tell you how incredible it is, because I know how difficult it is without the situation we're dealing with now to do what they're doing, to raise the money and to get people excited about something that doesn't have a U.S. Open or a PGA coming. And times have changed a little bit. That's helped them a little bit, but it's still a major uphill fight without, you know, the insanity that has now ensued.
Have you seen are there other municipal projects that maybe come to mind at all that are maybe a little bit more similar to what National Links Trust was originally trying to do with East Potomac, where that were bringing a major tournament was not involved? Obviously, the two that you mentioned, Torrey Pines and Bethpage, that now that these plans from the administration rolling along, that a lot of people point to as, oh, it's good, East Potomac is going to be the next Bethpage or Torrey. And the first thing that comes to my mind with those two is, well, okay, well, Bethpage has just an enormous amount of land. I mean, they've got five golf courses up
multiple,
there. Yeah, and Torrey's exactly. got 36 holes itself, much right. more land than East Potomac, where East Potomac just doesn't have that. But are there other, I mean, now there certainly seems to be more municipal renovation and restoration projects going on. But as you know, when you first heard about what National Links Trust was trying to do, was there a comp?
I don't think there is. And I'll say, I mean, that's not a knock on some of the, there's some, you know, fantastic stuff going on in municipal golf. You know, you can just take your pick of cities. There's still a long way to go, but there are a lot of places that have started to see some form of rejuvenation and nod to the past and appreciation for what they have. But in terms of the ambitiousness, and I say that with all, you know, full respect for what they're trying to do, because the property has a lot of needs and a lot of different constituents. And then it has this golf course by Travis that had this truly unique, and I hate that word, but it just is a concept that was carried out, and you have aerials that look amazing. And so nothing in the United States, it's comparable in terms of that. But again, there's all sorts of great projects out there. Even the UK had an interesting project, the RNA did. Totally different concept, though, but it has the same, you can see the same impact on the neighborhood and bringing all the constituencies together. And we know that's just a beautiful thing when you can do that, because it makes people appreciate golf more, and it makes people appreciate the just the facility or the other facilities attached to it. So it just has the potential to be this amazing community asset.
Yeah. I mean, one of the reasons I wanted to bring you on was imagining, you know, Joe Blow golfer listener who may or may not play East Potomac now, but is, you know, maybe is a golfer in this region, and trying to kind of paint a picture or understand the differences between the two proposals. The original one that involved National Links Trust and the restoration of Walter Travis's reversible design that was going to involve Tom Doak, and then what the administration is proposing currently. And why don't let's start, you know, going off of what you just kind of alluded to. The original Walter Travis design, you know, there's still not many reversible designs in the United States, right? I mean, you've got, was it Bobby Jones in Atlanta? You've got Doak's other one in Michigan, the Loop.
Yeah.
Are there, I imagine there's got to be a couple others in design or in progress, but
I do not know of anything else I think there might have been something announced recently that was doing that, but nothing, no, nothing comparable, and certainly nothing done over 100 years ago.
What do you think, you know, before we get into, you know, the current proposal, but how good could it be? The National League Trust has been the steward of these of East Potomac for whatever it is, 5 or 6 years now, and conditions have greatly improved, but it's still not, you know, it's still not a world-class golf course or even design. There's still the bones of what Walter Travis designed, but you know, the greens are pretty flat, and there's not much action on any of the greens. There's not much movement, and so it's not that, you know, they've improved conditions quite a bit, but it's not what could be. If they were allowed to move forward and restore Walter Travis's original design, how good could it have been, or could it be?
Yeah, I mean, it's a tricky question, because everybody has different views on what makes a golf course great and a facility great. And again, this is where, you know, that idea of a true championship course sort of clouds people's judgment. And again, the beauty of this project is that it wasn't seeking to create something that really isn't very useful for the everyday golfer. I mean, Bethpage Black and Torrey Pines South are not fun, and they're work, they're hard work,
sure,
and they're difficult golf courses. And the good news, though, is I think that we have. I did a book 20 years ago, just over 20 years ago, called Grounds for Golf. It's just been reissued, and I wrote about. I chucked a few chapters and wrote a new introduction. And the thing I focused on was in this time. The course we did, Rustic Canyon, when it opened, people would kind of say, oh, it's fun, you know, and kind of in a condescending way almost. And now here we are almost, well, a little 25 years almost later, and fun is now appreciated, and it's almost demanded. We're not quite there yet, but fewer golfers are hung up on when it reopens. Well, you know, let's say it's East Potomac, what's the slope and the rating, and will it be ranked in the top, whatever. Yeah, no, who cares? It's about, yeah, is it fun? Does it function better? Are they able to maintain it? Is it more sustainable in terms of the everyday product they put out? And did they make improvements with the infrastructure for the long-term good? And then is it a place that's, you know, maintain its affordability for residents, and but again, is it enjoyable to play? Is it interesting? And so for me, from what I've seen of the concept, even if they watered it down a little bit just because of whatever, you know, the water table and having to accommodate some things, it still would be it would just be an incredible piece of architecture in the United States, and given the setting and then the concept of the design and what's there now, it would just be an amazing transformation for the everyday golfer.
Sure. And with as much as you've written about golf and kind of followed the trends of golf course architecture and what people, you know, like and appreciate, you kind of alluded to it a little bit right there with Rustic Canyon, but this idea of a little bit more of a quirky design, or a little bit more less of a championship design, and a little bit more personality. I mean, that's what, I mean, even the rankings, it feels like I started to come around on some of those things. If you look at a lot of the different best in state lists, Sweetens Cove is not hosting any professional golf tournaments yet. It is the number one golf course in Tennessee in just about every publication. So I would imagine that you've seen quite a shift in, you know, what golfers appreciate and like where it comes to this golden age renaissance, people bringing back the uniqueness and character of these old designs.
It's been incredible. Yeah, the rankings are getting there. I mean, a big victory really for golf architecture in a sense, although I don't know if Golf Digest has the influence it used to have, but its resistance to scoring metric was just did, you know, incredible damage to the game in the United States by rewarding just being difficult, you know. And it's like,
sure,
it's judging the 100 greatest movies and giving points for most difficult to sit through and the longest and most agonizing. So yeah, well, great. Yeah, I mean, Schindler's List is a great movie, but it would, you know, it'd get a 10 in that category.
Right.
But that shouldn't.
Can you expand on that a little bit? Because the average person, I read Jonathan Cummings' book about the ratings game, but the average person probably doesn't know, you know, what you kind of just alluded to, or Golf Digest, and I don't know, I can't remember how much maybe Golf Week and Golf Magazine bring difficulty into their rankings, but there's so many people that are obsessed with top 100s and chasing lists and stuff like that.
Yeah,
can you expand a little bit about on what you're alluding to as far as like how Golf Digest would view difficulty?
Yeah, well, the original ranking was the 200 toughest courses in the United States, and so it started from that place, and they retained this resistance to scoring of their six or seven criteria, and so it until very recently, until I think either one or two versions of the top 100 ago, they finally got rid of that and realized that, you know, that's just not something to reward. There were other categories that would acknowledge whether the course tests a good player and is still playable for the average person kind of thing, which is a bit of a cliche, but it is what you would love to see in a lot of courses, that they balance that. And it's what the old architects, when people talk about these names and modern architects like Tom Fazio sort of poo-poo and roll their eyes at, but it is the defining trait of what made those old architects great. They built hard golf courses back then. When you think about the clubs and that were being used, now they also weren't as over-irrigated, so they played a little shorter than maybe when we look at a scorecard and we think, my gosh, that was 7,000 yards in 1929. But so those guys managed this delicate art of creating a course that could host a tournament and be difficult, but that everyday golfers could go out and enjoy. And it's always been something since then, since the golden age, if you will, the 20s, that has been a bit of a struggle for architects. And some of it is very much related to the technology changes in the game. Some of it's just bad design, lazy work. Some of it's trying to feed the trends of the moment. You know, a really fun day-to-day course with a subtle, you know, there's a green with a bump right in the front middle that you've got to be on the left side for the left pin and the right mm-hmm. side for the right pin. Something subtle like that doesn't translate to a magazine photo. And so a lot of designs for a long time were very magazine driven and imagery driven. And then it's gotten even more extreme with Instagram.
Sure.
So yeah, there are elements to all of this with architecture that really have nothing to do with your everyday enjoyment or the everyday maintainability of a course. And but that is why those old guys were so good at what they did. They were able to balance that and make the courses a beautiful walk and an enjoyable stroll, even if you were not that great.
So do you think that, well, you kind of mentioned that the Golf Digest playability ranking did more damage than they'll ever know to the golf industry.
Resistance to scoring. So, yeah.
Resistance to scoring, sorry.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, it sounds like you're saying that, you know, that those rankings and that kind of that piece of it kind of wagged the dog a little bit as far as how design then came and the Tom Fazios and maybe the Reese Joneses of the world kind of viewed what they would build. Is that fair?
Oh, no question. Absolutely. I mean, it's depressing to think about some of the great sites that were not treated properly because somebody was trying to get to a certain number. You know, one of the things whenever I'm bitching and moaning about the distance issue, I always point out to somebody that's arguing with me that if you notice people like Bobby Jones, Jack Nicklaus, Tiger Woods, now Rory McIlroy, although Rory is not count in this story just yet, but sure. Most of the people, those big names who were for a rollback usually came to that conclusion trying to design a course on a nice piece of property, but realizing to make a really cool reachable par five or a true great long hard par four, they were running out of acreage, and they realized and that the footprint of golf was not sustainable if you just keep expanding. And it's not just the sustainability thing and the cost. It's just the enjoyment and the you know, and working with a topo map and going, well, we don't own that land back there, but we need that for the tee. And you go, well, this is just stupid. Why are we doing this? Sure. Why are we compromising good golf for, you know, just chasing distance? And so, yeah, that's kind of where this whole, where you realize that, that trying to please a panelist who plays there once and showing that it's hard led to, I mean, Jim Ng was like the Golf Digest guy of the moment in the 90s. Apologies. We have a siren in the background. And he just built these things that were really hard. Mike Stranz built, at least his had some artistry to them, but they were so hard. And there's no doubt that a lot of these people, and Fazio included, were building for, you know, a developer who wanted to be ranked. And it just led us to a lot of places that we're now seeing being that damage being undone. And so, and that's another reason why this project is so exciting, because again, it's not being done to get ranked and to get good coverage in a magazine spread or an Instagram spread.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, it isn't the property for that. It's not a large enough property for that. But yeah, so let's get back to this project. So, you know, tell us a little bit about, I want to get into Tom Fazio specifically now, because, you know, once the lease was canceled by the administration, the National X Trust lease, which was canceled on New Year's Eve, again, the timeline's a little fuzzy, but, you know, it didn't take a genius to kind of assume or figure out that Trump was likely going to go with Fazio as he took over the project. Although, before I even say that, I reread your article that you wrote in December titled A Travesty in the Making on the Quad. And you mentioned something that I don't think I skimmed over the first time, or I don't think I'd seen elsewhere. You alluded to the fact that he maybe reached out to Corin Crenshaw first. Is that accurate?
He did.
I don't think I knew that. And they said no, and they just kind of said no, we're busy doing other stuff.
Too busy, yeah.
Got it. But Fazio has done at least I know he did the renovation here locally of Trump DC, the former Lowe's Island in Sterling, Virginia.
Did he?
He did the renovation, I believe.
Okay. Did he renovate his nephew, or who? I can't keep the family straight. I thought Jim Fazio did that one originally, but I don't know.
You may be right. We'll have to fact check ourselves. I thought when all this news break, I was trying to figure out, you know, how much Fazio, you know, the ties between Fazio and Trump. Maybe I saw a last name. I'll have to double check.
Well, yeah, because Jim Fazio did work for Trump as well.
Okay.
And so it is a little confusing. He did Trump International, the one down in Palm Beach area, the one by the prison. Trump International, I can't remember the last part of it.
Sure. So how much do you know of their history together, Trump and Tom Fazio?
Well, they've worked together on, obviously, Trump Bedminster's the biggest, I guess, success, if you will, and it was going to host the PGA Championship, which got pulled and moved to Southern Hills after Trump's comments about immigrants, which is pretty amazing to think where we were then and where we are now, that cost him a major. And now we have, you know, the PGA Tour basically almost practically begging their way back to Doral to appease him. So it's pretty wild. But so that would be their biggest success story, I guess. And I know they've worked on other things, but Trump's worked with a lot of different people. Clearly, you know, Turnberry was with Martin Ebert, McKenzie and Ebert, and Trump Aberdeen was Martin Hautrey. So he's gone through a lot of people. I mean, Jack Nicklaus, who's endorsed him twice, never wanted to work with him on anything. And now he's, you know, a huge fan. So, you know, the ability of people to delude themselves and for whatever reason is a part of the story, as we know in this time, and certainly the case with Fazio. He's supposedly retired and now seems to be working a lot again. And it's not clear whether he's going to take a fee. And even if he says he's not taking a fee, there's all sorts of ways that he can profit off of this through contractors and things, allegedly. It's just pitiful on many levels, so we can get into why. But I mean, the main reason is just his disdain for the old architects. And I've always found it disgusting. I've written about it. I did a little novel. The character was patterned after him when he started screwing around with Augusta, and he just made awful changes there. I mean, he's really been except at Pine Valley, Augusta, and Riviera, which he's, I think he's only been to Riviera like twice. But those are the only courses, the classic courses that I know that he's worked at that still listen to his horrible ideas. Everybody else has moved on. Wingfoot's had to have Gil come in and correct things. I mean, the list of places that have needed to undo his work, obviously Oak Hill and Inverness, the most famous. But he just shouldn't be anywhere near a classic course.
But for someone that doesn't know kind of the background on, you know, when you say his disdain for the history or kind of his viewpoints on the classic architecture, like how would you sum that up? Like what is the basis for your, you know, you saying that essentially about him?
Well, so start with this. I mean, he got into the business with his uncle George Fazio, who was a great golfer, and sort of fed off that name. And then, you know, their work was decent because George was a good player. And yeah, there was something interesting in some of the courses that I've played of theirs. Excuse me. But then when he kind of went out on his own, and this has happened through the history of golf architecture, Robert Trent Jones did the same thing. Even though essentially what they're doing is a version of the old architects, only dumbed down and more boring, they are essentially taking the style and the work of the McKenzies and Thomas and Tillinghast and Ross and the groundwork laid by those people and sort of trying to carry that on, but doing it terribly. And so just the idea that you don't have respect for those people who came before you, you totally locked into this profession. You're essentially a nepo nephew, and that you don't just at least give a cursory sort of nod to those guys. So if you pick up his book, which I don't recommend anybody do, it's a boring coffee table book, but he keeps referring throughout to the so-called golden age, the so-called classic courses, and that disdain for what we know even if they weren't classics, you should show some respect for these people who laid the groundwork and have allowed you to make a very lucrative living. And so that was my first sign that he was really just bad news when it came to getting anywhere near a good golf course. And yeah, and really his living has been made off real estate developments and selling real estate. So he has no interest in the great old designs, why they're great. His whole thing is just money and moving things around and framing, and I'm great at hiding cart paths. And I mean, it's just as shallow as you can get when it comes to, and this is not a, you know, particularly deep profession. This is not, we're not curing cancer here, but for somebody who has made a lot of money off of supposedly being this sophisticated visionary, he just completely lacks it. And so letting him get anywhere near a golf course that has some sophistication to it is it's heartbreaking. It's terrible.
He does somewhat allude to what you're saying in that recent interview that Alan Bastable did in on golf.com,
yeah,
where he basically says, you know, these golden age architects wouldn't have done the designs the way they did if they had the modern equipment and for the modern game. That it's just, it's almost, just, you know, he's just saying it's just, it was a product of their time versus,
skill involved. Let me tell you something about that. That really pissed me off. Because even today, even some of our minimalist best architects, I think, are frankly too much a product of kind of the modern way of doing it. And the reason the old guys were so good was that they didn't have the equipment they have today. They took their time. You know, when they were given the responsibility of transforming a piece of land, they took it so much more seriously now than architects do, in wanting it to blend in, to fit in. Perry Maxwell was very passionate about this, and leaving the earth behind in a way that showed respect for the earth. And when you hear somebody say, well, tour player go, it feels like it's always been there. You hear that all the time. Or you even hear other, you know, everyday golfers. And I wrote about this in my Golf Architecture for Normal People. There's this underfoot feeling when you walk on a property that is shaped with an eye toward retaining the natural feel. But maybe it's been rearranged for golf or filled because you just couldn't make it work, whatever. But they did it to leave behind something that respected the land, respected the earth, and that translates to the golf and the enjoyment factor of the golf. And we have too many people now who just come in, they rearrange crap, and they move the water, and they have catch basins everywhere to catch the water, and you get divots all around them. Just schlocky, bad work. To somebody who, if you've played the old courses or played the Great Links, you go, what, you know, it just feels manufactured. So yeah, so when sure. he's talking, you know, like, yeah, those guys would come back today and just be sloppy and do it in a hurry and run up a big tab, it's obnoxious. It's really obnoxious.
So that's kind of, that segues into, you know, how do, you know, after summarizing his kind of thoughts and feelings and all this, how does that manifest itself in his designs? Then looking at what he's proposing here at East Potomac, what should the East Potomac golfer, if these plans were to proceed and Tom Fazio redesigns this, what are we to expect?
Something very long. Something very long, probably with, you know, he's very into the every hole by itself thing. So attempting to create separation between the holes, overshape. I mean, I have no idea how they're going to bring in enough earth to deal with the water table and some of the other elements of the site and get 18 holes and all that stuff and the 40 acre range or that ridiculous looking driving range that was, I think, being repositioned. So you aim toward the Washington Monument. I tried to measure it on Google Earth. That it might be the biggest range I've ever seen. Of course, it has to be 400 yards deep now because the ball goes farther. But I think the real key to understanding Fazio is how many of his courses he's had to go back and redo because they're so boring. They're so vanilla. They're so devoid of character. And I mean, it's a long list of places, and it's amazing they bring him back and, yeah, Tom, it's not very interesting. And even his masterpiece, you know, Wade Hampton, all these so-called other genius designs, they're boring. They're not interesting. Because he doesn't, you know, bunkers are placed for aesthetics and framing.
Sure.
Everything's about hiding cart paths and beauty and the eye. And that's great. I mean, an architect should, when you stand on the tee, try to make a hole as visually attractive as possible. But sometimes it's just not possible because of the surrounds or the land or the scale of the property, what have you. But he's essentially a glorified landscape architect and doesn't come at it in any way with any kind of golf soul, any appreciation of the great holes, putting twists on little template holes or twists on another hole he did that everybody really loves. And so you just get something that lacks soul. And it so unfortunately Golf Digest propped him up for years because, you know, he's very close with the editor there. And a lot of the criteria was built around a rewarded sort of what he did. People go play a place once, and it was a counter to Pete Dye in a lot of ways, a quieter, more graceful, more traditional looking course, again, looking like the old architects did. And, but ultimately, when you pick them apart, there's just nothing there. There's no reason to want to, I mean, he just talked to a lot of different golfers, and you played one of his courses once, you don't ever need to see it again. And ultimately, that's not what you want. You want a course that people, it has some layers to it. And actually, first impressions are not that essential. You want something that grows on you.
You've kind of made this point throughout this conversation, but the one of the most common, you know, rebuttals to anyone, whether it's in a comment section about this project or anything like that, is, well, Tom Fazio he's got the most top 100 designs. He's one of the most popular folks out there. I think you talked a lot about the reason why. Have you seen his popularity decline? I feel like I have, just anecdotally reading stuff, but is his, you know, he himself and his style, he's certainly aging out, but is it, you know, are the developers of the world still hiring, aside from Trump, still hiring Tom Fazio?
I think he still does work with Mike Meldman of Discovery. And of course, Discovery projects are beloved and great more because of Mike Meldman and what he creates in terms of an atmosphere. But Fazio moves lots, apparently, and it's safe and and I guess works for him. But no, other than that, I mean, like I said, he had retired from the business. He's back now. And, but yes, I think there's a real fatigue with just kind of the boring factor and the number of places that have kind of had to be redone. He did a personal course in Texas. He's still very busy, and it's, but there's no question that, yeah, the golf architecture world's kind of moved on from him. It's just very clear. He's had his chance. He's had great sights. And yeah, there will be people out there who want the name, just as there are people still hiring Robert Trent Jones Jr. and Reese Jones off of a sure. name, because the name sells. And their father kind of proved that, Robert Trent Jones Sr. And again, he also did something that was what I find kind of gross. He sort of sold himself as a counter to the previous generation of architects, and people are sometimes drawn to that. But I do feel like, yeah, just the combination of the boring factor, the cost factor, you know, Fazio just doesn't do anything inexpensively, just runs up ridiculous tabs, moving things around. So to
that point,
we moved on, I think, from that in a lot of ways, thankfully.
Sure. To that point, as far as the cost and kind of the elaborate features that he's kind of known for, with what they have proposed, at least what, you know, at first the Secretary of Interior, Doug Burgum, posted on Twitter that Fazio was originally designed, although last Sunday it was spotted that they were carrying a much different design that went all the way to the water.
Whoops.
That you know, as an aside, in court the other day, the Department of the Interior lawyer sort of claimed that they were basically the same and didn't know that they were any different, those two designs, but that's neither here nor there.
Well, that just before you, that is going to be a very difficult part of this. Because even people who know golf will struggle to look at plans, but, and see differences until they really dig in. So that's just something I've seen it, and it can be confusing to a lot of people. You would think when you're looking at it's not like you're looking at the plan for a rocket or an engine, but it can be
obviously involved. I'm obviously involved in this lawsuit court case with the DOI over this whole project. But what seemingly, and this is more just me analyzing from my own take, but that they first came back with this Fazio design to appease some of the pushback and maybe even the court case, where they brought the constraints of the golf course design. This, I'm talking about the first Fazio design that was released by Burgum, within the current constraints, the current footprint of the golf course. They kept 1 9-hole golf course to check that box. They kept the clubhouse. They kept the mini golf course to check some of those boxes, while following what seemingly is the clear directive of the president that he wants it to be long enough to attract major tournaments. So I think it's stretched out to 7,500 yards. My guess is at some point in the last, whatever that stretch of time was, 4 or 6 weeks, you know, somebody looked at it closer and said, well, this is pretty tight. I mean, really, when you look at that first image, it got rid of 2/3 of the parking. Some of the holes didn't really even make sense. They were so jammed together that somebody decided, you know what, we really need more room. And they decided to go out to bring the golf course all the way out to the edge of the seawall, get rid of Ohio Drive. But in these new plans, it's tough to see, but you can clearly see it gets rid of the par 3 course and makes the range even bigger. What's tougher to see is it does look like the clubhouse and the mini golf course are gone, but that's a little bit gray. You can't really tell. But that's seemingly what is made gone. But my question to bring it back to you is, you know, on if that is, it's almost definitely, I mean, Trump has announced himself now multiple times that he wants a major tournament, whether it's a Ryder Cup or a big time tournament. He wants something big to be at East Potomac. One, do you think that's even possible logistically of the footprint of the land? Two, the logistics of, you know, what, you know, you obviously know major tournaments and what goes into them way more than I do, you know, the hosting of that. And then three, the timeline. You know, how long would it take? I would imagine, again, this is me speculating, that they want this done while he is still in office.
Yeah, well, and that's clear. They're gonna go ahead, no matter what some judge says. It seems like that's just gonna be the plan. And based on the other projects in the area that were, you know, it's the break things and apologize later or whatever Elon's nonsense is. But there are I mean, there are no open dates really on anything before, I think, 2035 or so, maybe six with the PGA Championship, maybe. Yeah, the major schedule is pretty jammed, and the Ryder Cup as well. Of course, Congressional has a Ryder Cup. I'm forgetting the year now, but it's not too far off.
PGA as well.
Yeah, PGA is what anyway.
I'm forgetting, but the
mid-2030s. Yeah, well, they've all committed so far out. I've lost track now, but yeah, in terms of logistics, it's, you know, right now Port Marnock is up and really wants an open, and it's in a similar, it's a kind of a similar footprint in a way that it's just this surrounded by water situation, but it has another golf course and the possible secondary road to be temporarily constructed over the water, but it's running into hurdles. I think they had planned to already commit to it, and they're still working on it. It'll probably happen, but this has way more constraints in terms of, and again, Port Marnock's a tough one, and the RNA wants to make that happen for the Open Championship because it'll be huge. But it's just looking at the property, it's really hard to see how all that can be done. Just the needs of, again, when you're building something bigger and longer and needs to be wider, and you need to elevate it more, and that shrinks things a little bit. So I just don't really see how any of that is truly possible, or why you would want to do that for 1 week in a 50-year period is a question I pose not just to this project, but to a lot of places because these organizations do ask a lot of the courses. And in this case, it would be a lot of things would need to be checked off to make it work. And I just don't see it happening, both because of the calendar and all the commitments already, and then also the property itself.
Looking at their plans and knowing that, you know, there's a massive seawall issue around East Potomac Park that needs to be fixed. You know, the flooding, you know, it looks like they do have some drainage ponds incorporated into the design, but you know, if we're talking about raising the entire property, which he's mentioned a couple times, how long in your estimation does that take?
Well, that adds, yeah, if you're actually having to basically bring in dirt to raise the property, that alone, that project alone is going to add months and months. I mean, I don't know where it would come from. I'm sure they have something, somebody has something in mind. But yeah, that alone right there, your normal year long of construction, let's say on a tricky site, is probably almost doubled with that. So that's just a massive thing amount of dirt to try to bring in. And again, I don't know where it would come from.
Can you talk a little bit about the history of Trump's obsession with wanting a major?
Well, I can give you a story that'll give you an idea of you know, the bad news, unfortunately, is how much this project probably has him excited and wanting to get involved in this. When he was running for president in 2016, I had visited Turnberry. I was going to write it just, the remodel had been of the hotel, and the golf course had been finished, and I was at Troon for the Open Championship, and I've told this story on another pod somewhere, but it was sensational. They did a beautiful job. They did it in a ridiculously short amount of time. When I was there, people suggested that they were well-financed. And that story has come out now by James Dotson, I think, shared that story that they were financed by certain oligarchs in a certain country, but that helped speed up the project. But it doesn't matter. They did a beautiful job. The hotel's not tacky, other than these two horrible fountains. But there's not much Trump tackiness. Everything was really well done. Golf course, Martin Niebuhr did a beautiful job making it better. There's, you know, a few tacky things. So anyway, I tweet something about it in advance of getting ready, and I'd written an article that would appear on Golf Digest, complimenting what a great job they did. And the Friday, I think it was like July 16th, the day he was to announce Mike Pence as his running mate, was the day Phil Mickelson lipped out on the last hole for 63, would have been the first 62 in major championship history. And I was out watching Phil. So I came in and let my editor know I'd like to write about Phil's round because I was there and saw it. And my phone starts ringing. It says unknown number. And I kind of had a feeling it was somebody who was a friend of Phil who takes a lot of credit for helping him with his short game, who also has an unknown number. And I went, I just let it go. I got to write my story. And so I start writing and I see there's a message and I, geez. And so I, listen to the message and it's Trump going on, Jeff, you're a real pro. Thanks for the great, somebody printed out my tweet. Of course, he doesn't look at digital versions. They print everything out for him. And he goes on and on. I save the message. And if he hadn't turned out the way he had, it probably would have been my voicemail message because he was so kind. Now, mind you, a few years before, he had tried to get me fired for a paragraph I wrote about Trump Aberdeen in an otherwise complimentary story that he was more mad about. Golf World placed him the 20th newsmaker, but we had a full article. Why would you do a full article for the 20th? Insane shit like that. Anyway, so I, whatever. The next day I'm playing at Prestwick. He calls again. I almost never go without my phone, but I left it in the car. I was playing with Jaime Diaz and after, in the evening, dreamy, it was wet, it was raining, but that was why I didn't bring my phone actually. And what it told me was just, he had not been to Turnberry since it was finished. That was, there is a point to this long-winded story.
Sure.
And he wanted to talk about the details of the work with me. Now he was also more lucid then, but still nuts. And, he's really into golf and, he really didn't, I really don't think he wanted to be president. It was a marketing thing. And as you see, he wants to be doing interior design. He wants to be renovating ponds and golf courses, unfortunately. And so that's kind of where we're at. And then that's the frightening part for this project, that it's not something he'll just quickly forget.
Yeah. That was going to be my last question for you is, based on that's a perfect way to end that last story is based on all that. How do you think this all plays out?
Well, I really hope that that the preservation aspect can somehow be protected and understood. Again, I don't know what a judge looking at plans will understand. I think it's probably pretty stark myself that a Walter Travis reversible design with multiple amenities and different needs for different constituencies being preserved and embellished versus an entirely new golf course would be the equivalent to a golfer, it'd be the equivalent of, instead of restoring a Craftsman home, building some, modern concrete and steel thing that's three times the size of the original and doesn't preserve anything. I would hope that that would become apparent and that slows it down. But again, that's a real fear of mine is that people, wow, it's a pretty plan. It looks great. It's green. It's got lakes. They've taken care of the range. It'll be a nicer range and people will fall for that. I hope that element of what the bones were and are and what it could be based on the original would be the thing that wins the day. But I'm obviously not very optimistic, as you can probably tell. But you're
sure
you're in court. You've seen what it looks like. I mean, you tell me, is that realistic that could win the day? That idea?
Yeah, I don't know. That's why I ask. I kind of go back and forth day by day. I mean, even in the most recent hearing, it was tough to read the judge, quite frankly. She kind of was admonished both sides for different things. She didn't want to play word games where the DOI's lawyer was saying that Trump may have said September 1st, but he didn't really mean it, or that there may be plans floating around, but it doesn't mean that we've actually made any decisions on a plan or an architect. And she quickly shot all that down, saying, that's all absurd. We all know that you follow the directives of the president and these things are in place. But at the same time, she wasn't necessarily as convinced that on what she could actually do to stop any of this, so we'll see. I spoke to our lawyer actually just before we got on this podcast, and he remains optimistic, but it's really anybody's guess at how this plays out, I think.
Yeah, and I guess the hard part for me, watching it from afar, and when I wrote my piece and talked to various people, that, you know, it's disappointing that the golf world hasn't been able to get through to him what a mistake this would be. I mean, the idea that they had a sort of blue ribbon panel, last ditch effort idea, and people like Fred Ridley and Tiger Woods were willing to lend their name to that, and that still hasn't deterred him, is it's concerning.
Why do you think that didn't resonate with him?
He's at a point where it's very clear a lot of these are projects to leave a legacy.
Sure.
And you're facing your mortality, and that's the thing that gets you excited. So you don't care if Fred Ridley thinks it's a bad idea. You're on this crazed mission to kind of leave behind your mark. And so that's what you're dealing with. That's frustrating because, you know, those are pretty weighty names that were involved. And it just seems that the USGA is afraid to get involved, that he's on their back about something. So it's, and then, yeah, there's the revenge element that if you cross him, that there's that component that probably has some people scared. I mean, look at the tour. Wanted no part of Doral ever again. And there they are playing a tour event in May. Yeah. That was a terrible idea. So it seems that people come are either afraid or come groveling back.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, listen, this has been great. I'm taking up a lot of your time. I really appreciate you, you enlightening some readers and giving some background on exactly, you know, what type of architect Tom Fazio is and your thoughts on the project. That you've done a great job covering it, even from the opposite side of the country.
Well, thank you, Alex. I'm sorry, one, for my little cough, and two, that no I worries. Couldn't be more positive about this, but it's just, it's a tough one, again, from the other side of the country to see, because, you know, we have so many great public courses that were built by the WPA, and that the National Links Trust, what it's trying to do, and the model that this would have set, it's just going to do incredible damage to that movement if this goes forward the way it's going forward. I don't think it's going to slow momentum of other projects, but I think we know that had this gone forward the way it was envisioned, it would have made, it just would have had an incredible influence on the rest of the country as well. So selfishly, you know, I'm interested in it, not just for the greater good of the area, but for all the places we have that are underappreciated for what they mean to the community. And part of that's because they've been allowed to sort of deteriorate. And so sure. I hope the National Links Trust can hang in there.
Yeah, and hopefully they will. I mean, with even if this project does get move forward at East Potomac, you know, through their work at Rock Creek and Langston anyway, that they can still have that impact. But it all remains to be seen.
Yep. Well, keep fighting the good fight. Appreciate what you're doing, and everybody back there. It's we're all very grateful in the so-called classic golf architect golden age fan club of the world.
Fair enough. All right. Thank you, Jeff. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Alex.